Okay, just a few thoughts this morning. I'm not going to give you a full thing. Well, hopefully not. I've only got 2 pages, so we should be right. So the story, today's Epiphany, which is the Feast of the Wise Men, the Feast of the Magi. So just a few thoughts about the Magi and the star today. It's from the Gospel of Matthew in chapter 2. Matthew's real concerns in presenting the Magi, and particularly presenting the birth of Jesus, to say who is the real king and what sort of king is he. So he sets up this comparison between Herod, who is the pretender Jewish king. He wasn't born king, he became king through military victory and Roman favour. So he's not really a king. It's suspect whether he's even really Jewish. And as compared with the Magi, who make no pretense of being Jewish, but they recognise who Jesus is, that Jesus is a true king, both of the Jews and also something bigger that brings something to the wider world, and they come to worship him. The second question Matthew's really concerned with is, how will you respond when you've had the opportunity to meet this king? Will you, like the Magi, drop everything and follow him? Will you oppose him for your or your country's political power, like Herod? Will you ignore the evidence and go on as if nothing had happened, as the religious leaders in Jerusalem do? So if that's you for today, just sit with those questions and that's enough. Who is the real king, and what do you do when you meet him? But when I read the passage, I have some other questions. The first one is, what's with the weird star? Because there is no known cosmic phenomenon that matches the description in this passage. This is talking about a celestial light so bright you can see it in the daytime. It moves east to west and then it changes direction and moves north to south. It's able to appear and disappear and reappear. And it's able to point out not only one small village but one particular house. Now, people have suggested some cosmic phenomenon that may have been going on to be this star, possibly that there was a comet. Halley's Comet passed the area in 12 BCE. It's a little bit early for us, but maybe there was one we don't know about. Some recent studies suggest there was a supernova visible in that region in about 4 and 5 BC, which is the era we're looking at. A supernova being the birth of a new star, which burns especially bright for a short time and then fades away again. There was also about the same time the conjunction of the planets Saturn, Jupiter and Mars, which only happens every 805 years. And those planets in the astrological world, Jupiter is the planet of the king. Saturn has some allusions to the Jewish realm because it's Saturn, it's the Saturday planet. There's some overlay that perhaps this conjunction would have led to the idea that something was particularly happening with the kings in the Jewish realm. But none of these really fit the description. They could have started the Magi on their journey and then myth extended things from there, but astrology got them as far as Jerusalem, perhaps, but then they needed to pay heed to Jewish tradition, to the authorities, to the sacred texts, in order to get from Jerusalem to Bethlehem. If there was a guiding star, why did no one else follow it? Especially after all Jerusalem, it says, was talking about the Magi being there. And particularly, why were Herod's spies not able to figure out which house the child was in if the Magi had a star pointing to it? So, there's a few problems with the star image as presented if we're looking to read it literally. The ancient world didn't have a concept of stars as massive balls of burning gas billions of light years away. In the ancient world, on the whole, stars were considered to be living beings. They were watching humans and they were interacting with humans. This is the basis of the kind of astrological charts, is that those are living beings interacting with you. So there's no cognitive dissonance for the readers of this text to have a star come down to earth and guide people, even to a particular house. We've been rereading Narnia at our house recently, and this is exactly what the stars are like in Narnia. If you've read Narnia books, the stars can come down and talk to you. They retire to the islands, the stars in Narnia. It's very nice. Apparently, in the stuff I've read this week, there's lots of examples in early traditions of star and angel being used as interchangeable words. Some of the Exodus traditions talk about the pillar of fire or smoke or cloud that goes before the Jewish people as they flee from Egypt in the same language that could be star or angel. So there's a tradition of a heavenly guiding figure who's a living being being described as a, you know, the thing of light, the angel. Angel just means messenger. So were the Magi perhaps led by an angel? Perhaps they were inspired by events in the heavens like a supernova or something, and that started them in the right direction, and then an angel took them the rest of the way. Which would explain why no one else went there, because it was their personal guide. This is all, you know, speculation, but are we more inclined to accept the shepherd's angels in Luke than the oddly personal star in Matthew? So that's one of the questions I've got. I don't have an answer, I'm putting some thoughts. But never mind the star. If a fancy caravan of exotic travellers visited some peasants in Bethlehem, anyone in town could have told Herod's spies which house they went to. But apparently nobody did, even when their children were killed. So who were these Magi? And there's a tendency to view the Magi as kind of the mark of class in the nativity scene. You've got all those peasants and stinky shepherds, you've got the pregnant teenage mother, lowing cows, stinky straw, and then, oh, now we've, thank goodness, the royal visitation from foreign lands turns up and it's lifted the game a bit. I'm going to suggest that's not what's going on. Now, a couple, we don't know how many there were. The tradition of there being three just comes from the fact that there are three named gifts, and that it's presented in the plural. Magi is a plural word. The singular is magus. That was my thing for the week, magus. The three, as Rochelle said, the three gifts of frankincense, myrrh and gold. Myrrh, sometimes in Christian tradition, a whole lot is made of myrrh being a spice used for burial. Probably Matthew is not trying to make that link, because when he gets to describing the crucifixion and the burial, he uses a different spice. And you'd think if he was trying to make a literary link, it's all set up to reuse myrrh, and he doesn't do it. So probably the gifts are just intended to show that the gifts are lavish. They're very expensive. Neither of those spices are sourced in Palestine. They both have to come from Arabia or that direction, from Africa. So they're imported expensive spices and, of course, gold. The fact that they're gifts that could be easily sourced in Arabia has led some to suggest that the Magi came from the Arab Peninsula. And there's overlays of parallel between the Queen of Sheba coming to visit Solomon and the Magi coming to visit the baby Jesus. And there's lots of different ways that this story is presented as Jesus in a new King Solomon, a new King David. And so this is an overlay, which raises questions about whether the Magi were possibly women, because the word could be used for men or women. They're not necessarily male visitors. They could be from Persia, from Iran, that's where the word Magi is most commonly used for people. Or they could be from Babylon, Mesopotamia, which has a particular tradition of watching the stars, and also has an expat Jewish community remnant from the exile. So they would have had an understanding of Jewishness and Judah as a place that you might think about doing things. But what the Magi were not was kings. They especially were not Caspar, Melchior and Balthazar, who turn up in the Middle Ages. Although I really like Balthazar, the black king at the manger. It's just great. So hold on to him if he's important, but he's probably a myth. Oh, I can say absolutely confidently, Balthazar is a myth. They might have been advisors at the beck and call of kings, but the word magus, it's the same word that underlines magic or magician. They are practitioners of occult arts. So that includes astrology, but it's the same word used for fortune tellers, magicians, sorcerers. If we were to translate it, the word witches is probably closer than the word kings. These were activities specifically prohibited in Jewish teaching, and by extension also in the Christian community. And if the speculation that they could be women, then witches even more so is a possibility. This is an outrageous addition to the story, especially in Matthew. Matthew is trying to prove that Jesus is the Jewish Messiah. He's trying to show his Christian community, which is in conflict with the Jewish community of the time, that they are legitimate inheritors of the Jewish tradition. It is embarrassing to put a sorcerer as your witness to the birth of the Messiah in this place, particularly in a way that might suggest it's the dark arts that led them to Christ. Some commentators suggest that this is a clue to the fact that this story really happened, because nobody would possibly invent that. So why did a caravan of exotic travellers not get noticed? Maybe because they were social outcasts who snuck into Bethlehem quietly, probably unnoticed by most people, because they knew that that community considered them not quite right. And their depiction of being welcomed in Herod's court is actually a mark against Herod, whose Jewishness is suspect anyway. So it's not surprising to have him depicted conversing with experts in forbidden pagan practice. Right, so they're not kings, and now I'm going to tell you I don't think they were wise either. It's really, really dumb to visit a reigning king who's a known violent tyrant and claim allegiance to an alternate king. They come and say, we want to pay homage to the new king. They specifically say, the one born king of the Jews, which is Herod's sensitive point, because he was not born to the role that he's taken on. Stars and the guidance of stars, if there was a mysterious, unusual celestial event going on, half the population would have been saying, something's going on. So it wasn't particular knowledge of the stars or astrology that got them to where they were. And then they had to ask for help, and they asked Herod, of all people, for help. I suspect the Jewish audience hearing this would have dismissed their claims of wisdom as just plain ludicrous. Much in the way that modern Christians would react if someone claimed that tarot cards or palm reading or horoscopes had led them to Jesus. They are shown as wise only in that they respond to the presence of God. Their wisdom is paralleled in chapter 1 by the wisdom of Joseph, who's the main character of Matthew's chapter 1. Joseph's wisdom, and he's an ordinary peasant bloke, his wisdom is that he listens to dreams, he pays attention to angels, and he trusts God. And the Magi's wisdom is equal. And in that, the Magi's wisdom is accessible to any of us. So I think this passage is not about bringing the class to the shabby manger, but it's contrasting the high and powerful of Herod, the learned and titled religious leaders who all fail to respond, and the foolish Gentiles of ill repute, the low and the ignorant, who recognise Jesus as their hope and find themselves drawn into the shalom of God. And I really like the idea that they go home by a new route. This event somehow changes the way that they travel. So did any of this actually happen? This is probably one of the gospel stories that's hardest to accept as historically accurate, even for those of us who do accept a degree of divine in-reaching and supernatural. But whether it is true as a historical account or whether it is true as a parable, it still raises questions for me, and they're the same sort of questions. So these are my questions, but you might have other questions, and my invitation is to sit with what are the questions this passage has raised for you as you go into the week. For me, this story asks me, how do I respond to the presence of God, especially in unexpected places and unexpected people? I am challenged to say, am I dazzled by cleverness? What might I be missing if I only listen to the learned, the respectable voices, the socially acceptable ones? And when I come close to Jesus, how do I respond? Do I buy into the status quo of violence like Herod? Do I react with complacency? How many times have I heard the Christmas story? Or do I kneel in front of this Jesus and offer him my all?